Welcome to the Flight Bridge Ed podcast series.
Hey folks, Eric back with you. I want to start off by saying thank you for all the nice emails. I continue to get emails daily asking different questions or people bringing up great cases that we can discuss in the podcast series. I also want to say I just apologize for the delay in the podcast release. I have been extremely busy over the last 6-7 months. As you, many of you know, I'm building a house, and we're just completing that project, and that's consumed every ounce of my extra time. So there has been about a 6-8 week lapse in podcasts, and we're going to jump back on a normal schedule starting with the release of this podcast. And I have two more podcasts in the works at this point. Both of them are going to be case studies. Both of them are going to be case studies in our Nightmare series. Today's podcast is going to be a short podcast, probably 10 or 15 minutes. And what we're going to talk about is a concept that's been around for a long time, primarily used in anesthesia. But I think when you look at this concept and you look at the literature, you look at the data, it's a concept that makes complete sense. And it's something that we as critical care providers in the EMS and HIMSS industry can learn a lot about. Many of you know I work for Air Methods full-time as a regional flight paramedic. You know, one of the things about working for a company of that size is they have a lot of data. And a lot of flight companies, big companies, small companies, look at Air Methods because of the data that they can release. And they'll make decisions based on that data. They employ a scientific advisor that actually does constant research on different topics and concepts. And one of the concepts that they're seriously looking at is a concept called push pressors in conjunction with RSI. For those of you that don't know what that means, it's to give a potent alpha stimulator prior to RSI in severe hemodynamically unstable patients, secondary to trauma, sepsis, anything that has the patient decompensating and really attempting to clamp down. On the same token, they need airway management. They need airway assessment. And by doing that, they have a gag reflex and we have to perform RSI. So the concepts are just this. They've looked at hundreds and thousands of different cases, and the paradigm is shifting to, like I've said in many podcasts, less is better. You know, we've changed many things in the industry over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, whether it's giving less fluids and permissive hypotension and trauma, to, you know, giving less sedation medications because of the delirium and the studies regarding increased hospital stays, and we're starting to give more fentanyl. This concept, like I said, has been around for a long time. Anesthesia does this all the time. They do this for any patient that's like I said, hemodynamically unstable. They've just come out of surgery. They may be a post-heart. They may be, post-traumatic surgery. And the anesthesiologist will give a small push-dose pressor, most probably neosynephrine. It'll, you know, kind of boost their blood pressure, and they'll be able to transport them up to the ICU. The concept of push pressors in the EMS and HIMSS industry is regarding RSI in trauma, mainly. Trauma, like I said, sepsis, anybody that's severely hemodynamically compromised, where they're doing everything they can to clamp down, and they need airway management. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off with a small little case to kind of demonstrate why this is important, and then we'll jump into the concepts and the theory. All right, you have a 54-year-old male patient that was driving a forklift near his farm, and the ground was soft. He was near the shoulder. The ground gave way. The forklift started to roll over, and he attempted to jump out. He jumped out, and he didn't clear the forklift. The forklift ended up rolling over on his chest, his abdomen, and his pelvis. He was transported by local EMS to the local flight service, and he was loaded into the helicopter. On primary assessment, the patient revealed equal bilateral breath sounds. He was diaphoretic. He had palpable femoral pulses, but no radial pulse. He looked a little bit pale and ashen, and he was very, very agitated, although with a GCS of 15. They lift and they get in route, and his initial blood pressure is going to be 75 over 40. So this kind of lays out what I'm talking about. You have a patient that is severely hemodynamically compromised. He most probably has internal chest trauma. He could have liver and spleen involvement. He could have a pneumo beginning. Remember, his lung sounds were clear and equal bilaterally, but that doesn't mean really anything in this context. As the flight crew is transporting the patient to the level one trauma center, they note that the secondary blood pressure was 68 over 38. So they start discussing airway management. And in this setting, you know, you have to kind of weigh what's going on. Is the patient's airway stable? And if it's not stable, why is it not stable? Can you assist them in any way? The flight crew decides to kind of employ the permissive hypotension criteria. They do start a secondary IV. He was initially transported with one good patent large bore IV. They start a second IV, and they give a large fluid bolus. The patient's complaining of severe chest pain. He does have some mild crepitus due to some rib fractures, and he is given 100 mics of fentanyl despite his blood pressure being 70, 68 systolic. Blood pressure really remains unchanged with that fluid challenge, and the third blood pressure is now 76 over 46. So remember, even if you have a patient that is hypotensive, they're still in pain. Fentanyl is an excellent medication. It's low doses, 50 to 100 mics at a time. You're not going to have that huge catecholamine release. And so it's appropriate to continually give these patients pain, especially if they have rib fractures, a flail segment, things like that. That's going to help them with their breathing. It's going to help them go from a tachypneic, real shallow respiration to a more deep respiration. For somebody like me, I have had a flail chest. I have had a pneumothorax, and I can tell you that was the worst aspect of it, is I just couldn't take a deep breath. My breathing was very, very rapid and shallow, and the pain medication really did help in that context. So I'm always very kind. Obviously, you have a patient that's hemodynamically unstable, and we have to take care of that. And we're doing that with a patient that is older. So you have to be careful with your dosing, and I think 100 mics is probably the max in this situation. Another medication that you could use in this situation is ketamine. We've talked a lot about ketamine. Ketamine is primarily used for an induction agent. Remember, it's got great beta 2 response, so you're going to have some bronchodilation. Really great for pediatrics with any airway resistance or airway disease. And but we can give this in the trauma situation based on your protocol in RSI or continued sedation, because it's got great analgesic effects, it's got great sedation effects, and it's going to be very, very stable on a low blood pressure. You're not going to have a precipitous drop in pressure secondary to giving that medication. So at this point, you attempt to reassess, you know, chest rise and fall. Once you're in the helicopter like this, chest trauma, unless you have a patient intubated, remember, you can't really assess if your patient is becoming more agitated secondary to a tension pneumothorax. I mean, if you don't have them on a ventilator, you can't assess a plateau pressure. Really, how are you going to assess if that chest has become tensioned? And a lot of times, if your patient has increased agitation or anxiety, that's kind of a grounds to do a chest decompression, because there's really no way for you to know. Remember, blood pressure, saturation, heart rate, things like that are going to be a very late ominous sign showing a decompensation regarding a tension pneumothorax. So a lot of times that's going to be, you know, you're just going to do it just to make sure that that's not what's going on. Continuing, your patient's heart rate is in the 50s, and at this point, he's becoming more agitated. He's complaining of more severe chest wall. You know, his diaphoresis is getting worse. His respirations are slowing down. So this is where you have to decide, what road are you going to go down? His blood pressure now is 58 over 32. So you have a patient that now has a gag reflex. He's severely hypotensive. He's got severe chest, abdomen, and pelvic trauma secondary to a forklift that's 10, 12,000 pounds that's rolled over on him. He's gray and ashen. And so this is a patient that needs immediate airway management. So we can go down two roads right here. We can go down the standard road of let's give our standard medications for RSI, which is fentanyl. I've talked a lot about fentanyl pre-RSI, great for the pain aspect. Intubation is extremely painful. Giving a dose, depending on your protocol, of 1 to 3 mics per kilo. Obviously, this patient is severely hypotensive, and I would probably stay away from that huge 3 mic per kilo dose. You've already given him 100 mics of fentanyl, so I would probably just use that as a pain dose and leave it at that and skip that. The next medication on a standard RSI protocol is going to be Etomidate, right? Etomidate is 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. Quick math, take their kilograms and divide that by 3, and that's going to be how many milligrams for your Etomidate. And then the last thing is your paralytic, and you can either use succinylcholine or some people prefer using ROC. Obviously, succinylcholine is very short-acting. We've talked a lot about that. There are some contraindications to that, or relative contraindications you have to be aware of, but they don't really fit this case. So succinylcholine is going to be probably your best bet, and that's going to be most probably 2 milligrams per kilogram for most protocols. This patient was about 100 kilos, so you know you go 200 milligrams, and we never exceed 200 milligrams. That's one vial, and you're never going to exceed that. So this is where we kind of change our thought process. In a standard RSI, we would give our succinylcholine, and we would hold BVM ventilations at that point, and we would perform laryngeal view with our laryngoscope or our CMAC, whatever our company uses, and we're going to place our ET tube. What the studies are finding, though, is we're having a lot, and this isn't just one specific company. This is all over the world. We're having a lot of patients arrest a minute, 2 minutes after RSI in a situation, in a presentation like this, where they're clamping down the best they can. They've got some type of massive trauma, vasogenic shock, neurogenic shock, where they're decompensating. Their body's doing everything it can to hold on to some type of perfusion. And we perform an RSI and we give succinylcholine. Well, what happens if we do that? Succinylcholine is a non-competitive neuromuscular blocking agent. Succinylcholine is made from 2-acetylcholine molecules, and essentially what it does is it floods those neurosynaptic junctions, it fills those junctions with acetylcholine, and it causes massive firing of all of our muscles, causing continued paralysis because it has filled all those neurosynaptic junctions and it doesn't allow for any further stimulation. Well, by doing that, now we've paralyzed everything. Our vessels now aren't able to constrict down, and we start having issues, and any compensation your patient may be having at that point is now gone. So we have a patient that's holding on. This patient, for instance, has a pressure of 58 over 32. We've given our medications, Etomidate and Sux, and you know, remember, Etomidate is going to drop a pressure as well. Even Versed, if you want Versed, is going to drop your pressure. So now we have a patient that is severely hypotensive. We've given that medication. We've given succinylcholine, and they arrest. And this is happening all the time. And so they're starting to look at the numbers. They're looking at the cases, and they all have very similar presentations. Huge amount of cases are being looked at specifically in trauma, in some type of blunt force or penetrating trauma, where you have a huge sanguination that you can't really see internally, and you give these medications and the patient arrests. And we usually chalk this up as the patient arrests because of his injuries. Now, obviously, the literature, we have no way of knowing down the road if we didn't give the succinylcholine, if we didn't perform airway management in that way, if the patient would have survived, you know, getting them to the trauma center or through surgery. The literature also shows that when we perform RSI, first pass success is very, very high. Most companies, maybe in the high 80s, low 90s, when performed with full RSI procedure. That means giving some type of sedative medication like Etomidate and then a paralytic, doing a complete RSI using a sedative, an induction agent, and then a paralytic. when you look at the numbers and you have a crew that only uses Automate and they attempt to do RSI with just Automate, the first pass success rate in those patients is 68% to 71% in the data that I've looked at. Second pass success is 90%, 91%. And when you look at why that is, remember we always want to change one thing. It's because on that second attempt, they've now given succinylcholine. Your patient now is fully paralyzed. You can get a good view. And so that data is telling me that when you use a full RSI procedure, Automate, whether it's fentanyl, Automate, succinylcholine, fentanyl, Automate, rocuronium, whatever you're going to do per your protocol, you're going to have better success, very, very high amount of success doing a full RSI. So that kind of takes us back. We have better success. We have first pass success doing a full RSI procedure. But in this case, by giving succinylcholine, we've now basically thrown out any compensation the patient may be having. So that gets us to the whole topic of push pressors. The other name for this is called a neostick. And like I said, anesthesia has done this for many, many years. And the concept behind this is very simple. Remember, neosynephrine is a medication that's got very, very strong alpha, causes great blood pressure increase because of that alpha squeeze, very little tachycardia, so you're not going to have that heart rate increase as well like you would with dopamine or other pressors. You have great coronary perfusion with neosynephrine. When we give this primarily, it's a great medication for neurogenic shock, vasogenic shock. Primarily, neurogenic shock is going to be your first line use for neosynephrine. We always load with a 10 to 100 mic dose, and then we can hang a maintenance infusion of 40 to 60 mics a minute. In the context of using this prior to giving any paralytics, and that's what we're talking about. So this is called a neostick. The literature is saying that if we give a patient a small dose of neosynephrine prior to RSI, all the studies are showing we have to do a full RSI to have first pass success in the 80s and low 90s. So to do that, we need to give them some type of squeeze to compensate for that succinylcholine administration. We can give two different medications. We can give epinephrine, which I'm not going to really discuss. I think phenylephrine or neosynephrine is the primary medication, the better medication. It's something we carry. So kind of the concept here is that you want to give them a small bolus. It's 0.5 to 2 mils. Every 1 to 2 minutes, or every 2 to 5 minutes in that range, based on kind of how you guys set up this protocol. And the best way to do this is phenylephrine comes in a vial that's 10 milligrams per mil. If you draw out 1 mil of that phenylephrine and you put it into a 100 mil bag of normal saline and you mix that really quick, and then you draw up 1, 2, 3 mils of phenylephrine from that bag, you basically have 100 mics per mil. So for every mil in that syringe, you have 100 mics. So a half dose is going to be 50 mics, and 50 to 100 mics for a push presser dose for neosynephrine is going to be kind of the standard. I've talked to some different physicians, some different colleagues, and they all agree that 0.5 to 1 mil is going to be a great dose for most patients. So that's exactly what you're going to do prior to giving your Automate and your sucks. You're going to give a good dose of phenylephrine, 0.5 to 1 mil. So that's going to be 50 to 100 mics. You're going to push that. You're going to wait maybe a minute, let that take effect, maybe 2 minutes, and then you're going to continue to manage that airway. You're going to use passive oxygenation techniques. Remember, we don't want to bag our patients if we absolutely don't have to. We don't want to cause a whole bunch of gastric air. So passive oxygenation, obviously if they become apneic or their respirations are down in the agonal range of you know, 2, 3, 4 a minute, obviously we're going to have to support those respirations. But if you use a nasal cannula at 8 liters per minute and then you use an on-rebreather breather at 15 from a second oxygen source, most of the time you can get great saturation throughout the RSI procedure. You're going to give your dose of phenylephrine, you're going to give your dose of etomidate, you're going to give your dose of succinylcholine, and then you're going to, you know, perform your ET2 placement based on normal techniques. I think this concept makes complete sense to me. Obviously, this is a concept that we can look at from the anesthesia standpoint. We're performing these procedures from the anesthesia standpoint, RSI. You know, these guys do it every single day. We can learn a lot from how they do things. And I think if you look back at the history of medicine, the history of EMS, and the evolution of HIMSS, and how much we're doing from emergency medicine to OB to internal medicine, you know, we kind of have to be the jack of all trades. This concept makes complete sense to me. I wouldn't be surprised if this is something that we see in the next, you know, couple years as part of many RSI protocols. I know, like I said, Air Methods is looking at this concept. They're doing a lot of study. This, our scientific advisor is looking at this and looking at a lot of cases. And I know that Scott Weingard from the MCRIT podcast, he uses this in all his RSI procedures, and he has great success. So continuing with this case, you know, if we look at how sick this man is, you know, his pressure is 58 over 40 prior to RSI. He would absolutely fit in the category of using this concept. At this point, we give our RSI medications, we give etomidate, we give sucks, we place an ET tube, and blood pressure, we give a fluid bolus. Blood pressure after RSI procedure is 80 over 48. Continue to the receiving trauma center, unload the patient, give a report, and as they're wheeling the patient from the trauma beta surgery, he arrests, and they attempt resuscitation, and he succumbs to his injuries in the OR. Like I said, this is just one example. This can happen with any vasogenic shock, any neurogenic shock. Sepsis, this is a big deal with. On top of the sepsis aspect, we also have to worry about metabolic acidosis. We have to worry about a really low pH. So, you know, we have multiple areas here. We have to maintain that airway. We got to control that airway. But on top of that, we have to also take care of the blood pressure. And we have a low blood pressure. So a Neo stick, if they're not already on pressors, may be warranted. Even if they're on pressors, you know, this is going to be, like I said, a bolus dose, and you can go all the way up to 2 mils, which, remember, 2 mils is going to be a 200 mic dose, and you're going to see some positive blood pressure changes. Now, remember, we have to support that blood pressure, so you're going to have that patient squeezed down with that Neo stick. Remember, always fill the tank. Got to fill the tank first. Well, that's all I have for this podcast. If you have any questions regarding this concept, please email me at eric.bauer@flightbridgejet.com, and I'll attempt to answer any questions. If you have any good cases that you want presented that's kind of out of the norm or has some great teaching points, please email me with kind of a scenario of what happened. You can always call me. My number is on my email, and I can forward that to you. We're going to be in Toledo, Ohio, the first week of December, December 6th and 7th. So if you're looking for a review class, we do have spots available. We do have a review class scheduled in Atlanta, Georgia, in late January, and we're in talks to do another one in Ohio, and that date is to be announced. If you're preparing for your FPC and you're looking for good literature, we do have our two books for sale on our website, and we do have a package deal. We have our practice exams, which I feel are industry leading, that you can always access. And you know, if you need one-on-one help, please email me, and I have an Adobe Connect classroom, and I have no problems sitting down with you and doing a live one-on-one session and going over concepts, whether it's ventilator management, advanced hemodynamics, balloon pump therapy, whatever you want to go over. I'm more than willing to take that time out of my day and sit down with any of you. So again, on behalf of everybody at Flatbridge Ed, we just want to thank you so much for listening, for being patient. And again, we're going to get back on a normal schedule podcast-wise and be looking for two more podcasts after this to be released in the next couple weeks on our Nightmare series. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon. We want to thank you for following Flatbridge Ed.